seated. Court is ready to hear argument in 030559 NRA Certain Underwriters at Law.
Okay, please report, Mr. Cole will present argument for the relators. The relators have reserved 5 minutes to rebuttal.
May I please report? Your Honor, I'm here this morning for a, as the list of parties in the brief shows, a fairly complex set of parties that subscribes to some insurance sold a long time ago in another state. It is now part of the broader problem that is broader than this case. It's a very far-reaching issue in this state and others, asbestos liability. But the specific issue that has brought that group of companies here is one of the lawsuits relating to that problem is pending in Dallas. It's been on file for some time. It continues to be on file. And for the last several months, just over $8 million in security has taken different forms, has been in the registry at the Dallas court. And our contention today, the contention of the London defendants, London relators, is that as a matter of the Constitution and as a matter of the relevant statute, it was inappropriate for the trial court to have required the posting of that security, and it is a matter that should be reviewed in the mandamus procedural posture by this court, and that order should be reversed.
Okay, if the trial court finds no breach of the CFP, you get your money back.
If we win, we'll get our money back. That's
and
correct.
And if you lose, you'll have to pay a certain portion of it.
Depending on what the outcome is, that's correct.
So why is there no adequate remedy why have you been irreparably harmed for mandamus purposes?
Because the money from now until the time that happens, which could be a long time if an appeal is taken, and we could be back before this
You've
court on
the
merits.
You've been deprived of the use of your money for a period of time.
That's correct.
But that's never been the standard for mandamus relief, as I understand it.
The standard in this context of prejudgment security, I think that is the standard recognized by the courts of appeals that have dealt with the issue, because otherwise it could never be reviewed. If we proceeded to final judgment in the trial court, appeal back to this court, and we had a judgment, and all that time it was wrong for us to have had the money in the registry of the court, we couldn't do something with our $8 million. At final judgment, the issue just goes away.
And how is that different from a post-judgment supersedious bond? I mean, the same thing happens there, doesn't it?
In that case, the judgment is in place. The statute sets forth certain safeguards and precautions for that placement. You put the bond in place, the execution is stayed, and
but
it stays at that
time. But
you don't
know if it's going to be upheld on appeal. I mean, you could take 5-6 years to appeal it, you never know.
True, but there have been.
But after supersedious, you've had a day in court.
Correct, and there have been
You
challenges.
Haven't had a day in court.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. The issue of due process here is that there must be at least some showing of how that's going to come out at the end of the day. There has not been. There certainly has been no day in court. And, Your Honor, there have been challenges to the constitutionality of supersedious bonds post-judgment, and they have been raised in a number of different postures. But the same basic issue is there. They come up in these tobacco cases. It came up in Texaco against Pennzoil, where there is a vast amount of money, the use is deprived, and the company is going to go bankrupt in those cases.
But that's not the case here.
No, it's not, Your Honor. We don't contend that we're facing the Dallas court is correct. The resolution of the merits of the case will not be affected by the pendency of this bond order being in place. They'll be able to pay their lawyers. The company will stay in business. And there have been cases that dealt with much more severe deprivations than what we have here. But it's still our money. It's our money, and it's a lot of money. And the freedom to use that money should be ours, unless there is some compelling reason to take that money from us, and we say that standard has not been met here.
The Mr.
Issue,
Cole,
Your Honor, please.
There's no dispute here, is there, that the relators are all unauthorized insurers under the statute, which doesn't prejudge the ultimate issue, but that's the case, isn't it?
If there had been a doing of insurance business in the state, then that's the label the bucket they fall in, is unauthorized insurers. If the threshold question of what the statute reaches doesn't, if we haven't been doing insurance, then we're not. But if you find that we've been doing insurance, we fall in that bucket as opposed to surplus lines or some other category.
Now, I understand your position is that the CIP is not a contract of insurance.
Correct.
As a predicate, let me ask you, do you agree with some of the legislative history that the codification of the relevant statutes from the articles to Section 101.051, the insurance code, that they affected no substantive change in the applicable provisions?
I believe that's correct.
That is what some of the legislative history says, and I didn't notice that anybody took issue with that in their briefing.
I think that's a good
sure. So under 101.051, it states that the following constitute doing business, the business of insurance in this state. One of those items is directly or indirectly acting as an agent, assisting an insurer in investigating or adjusting a claim or loss, and transacting a matter after the effectuation of a contract that arises out of the contract, the latter contract, I believe, being an insurance contract in the context. What's your best argument that the CIP doesn't at least do those two things, adjust a claim or effectuate a contract that arises out of an insurance contract?
I have two answers to that. The first is to read that statute in connection with the preamble language about what this whole set of statutes is supposed to address, and with what used to be the second part of the statute has now been broken out, which is carves out from that statute situations where you have a contract that arises from a policy sold in another state about a subject of insurance in another state. That I believe is not only the language of the statute, but it's a fairly crisp summary in the statute of the constitutional limit on how far the statute you refer to can be read. So with those two reference points, then let's look at the statute and look at the CIP. The CIP, the page that is relevant, it's page 14 of the CIP, section 8, says what this contract does not do. And it does not do anything about the underlying policies of insurance. It says that at some length in the first section. It sets up a framework for dealing with the question of allocation of payments and for defining when certain under and lower down insurance is exhausted. It sets those two things in exhaustive detail in section 5 of the CIP. But the process of adjustment and analysis and so on and so forth goes forward under the policies as if there was no CIP.
I understand that. There's no reimbursement, however, to Dresser unless the indemnity payments arose out of covered claims. Doesn't the CIP tie back to the insurance contract for every reimbursement in that regard?
No, Your Honor. The definition covered claims is a slippery term, but covered claims as used in the CIP is referring to the coverage of the CIP. The CIP takes the world of insurance claims against Dresser and breaks them into CIP claims and non-CIP claims. If it's a CIP claim and is a covered claim, it falls into the detailed framework for coverage and allocation that I've talked about. The issue of whether a claim covered by the CIP, subject to those calculations, is then in fact covered by the subject policies is not answered by the CIP. And the process for doing the things under that policy that would fall within that statute are addressed by those policies and not by the CIP. Final point, in answer to your question, Your Honor, nothing in this record shows, other than the text of the CIP itself, which says it's not an insurance contract, says that any of this activity is going on in Texas. The insurers are in London. Their main counsel, who all the correspondence is from dealing with this in the record, is Mendes and Mount in New York State. The people who have come here and asked to have this bond requirement imposed on us, Dresser, they haven't shown that those things are happening in the state other than to point to the CIP.
Well, address the assertions in the brief that the CIP was signed by Dresser's Houston agent, that there was some 500 or more lawsuits in Dallas County that were settled, and that Dresser filed a lawsuit over a similar or maybe part of the coverage dispute at issue here in Jefferson County.
Those are all statements from the recitals of the CIP. Those are all, to my knowledge, correct recitals as well.
But they're not sufficient contacts with Texas to hurdle that first threshold question you raised?
Those contacts show that there's the Dresser has, decades after the fact, now inherited these policies and insurance and raised claims based upon them, falling directly within the language of the exception that I referred to, which itself follows directly from the Supreme Court cases that define the power of Texas to regulate. Certainly, Dresser is in Texas, and certainly the coverage litigation is in Texas. But the things that have been done to resolve these aspects of this litigation in Texas do not come within the meaning of that statute and cannot come within it constitutionally. One point that I wanted to be clear about on this issue of statutory construction that I might have mixed in with some of the more specific answers to Justice Wainwright's question is this exception that has different numbers attached to it, and I won't bore you by reciting all of them, but the one that refers to and carves out from this insurance code section, old policies, out of state, negotiated out of state, that language is no accident. If you review the cases we cite in our Commerce Clause section of our briefing, that the words they are using in that statute, in that exception, are the words you see in those cases about what this state cannot do. And the very first provision in this set of statutes, after the one that defines the point of all this as being protecting people who are vulnerable from the predations of unscrupulous out-of-state insurers, certainly not Dresser, the next provision, 101.04, says you may not apply these in an unconstitutional manner. And that exception has to be read with that command with this case law as well. To follow up on a matter that Justice Brister alluded to about having your day in court, the statute as it is written here and as was applied by this trial court simply requires that you show this is a dispute about insurance and here's this company, post the bond, and in our case a very substantial bond. Contrast to the attachment statute, we have the citations for that in the briefing, requiring a showing of just indebtedness or that the attached party is justly indebted. And there is case law about that that we cite that talks about that being more than just conclusory allegations or relying on your pleadings or things of that nature. And that's in the statute, and the case law interpreting it has applied that. And there again, it is no accident that that phrase is in the statute and case laws come out that way, because to take something away from somebody, even if there's some reason for it, you've got to show that there's a basis in fact and law for doing that. And that follows directly from, I'll be on different fact patterns, but directly from Supreme Court cases and a number of due process issues. And that application is something that ought to be folded into this statute as well, although on its face it does not expressly call for it.
What type of appellate remedies do you have for that type of attachment? Is there a specific right of appeal, or has there been mandamus available if that's not done correctly?
I believe there have been mandamus cases. I believe there is one cited that is SRS World in our briefing. And I think that's a fair summary of the principles. I believe there could be others. And again, what else could you do? If you're deprived of something for years of litigation, there would simply be no other remedy. I think the due process issue and the Commerce Clause issue are heightened here because of just the lack of this statute to what London thought it was getting into back in the 60s when it sold these policies in London. No question about that. We have some cases in our footnote that describe this very unique process. Through an authorized agent in New York who followed the law in New York and was duly authorized in New York, would not be subject to a bond in New York. Decades later, there is a sale and another sale, all kinds of litigation, and based on that, even though it wouldn't have been okay back in New York decades ago, Dresser now wants to have this bond requirement imposed. And that passage of time between what was right back then, what Texas couldn't do, and what now it can do in Dresser's world, I think highlights the importance of those constitutional issues and shows why the statute should be read.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel. The Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. Patterson. Patterson will present argument for the real party.
Good morning. May it please the Court. First, I did want to address the question that Justice Brister had. I think he first brought it up about whether the London insurers had their day in court. I believe they did. They were given notice. There was a hearing. The motion that was filed by the real party in interest stated that the relators had been billed pursuant to the agreement, and that under the agreement, the monies are to be paid within 60 days of being billed. And the affidavit attached to the motion stated that, those monies had been billed and more than 60 days had passed. And the affidavit specifically stated that the, I can't remember the amount, it was $11 million approximately, that approximately $11 million was due under the agreement.
But it doesn't say they're likely to prevail on the merits of that dispute or anything like that.
Well, the relators were given their day in court. They had every opportunity to come in and challenge whether, in fact, that money is due under the agreement, which was our allegation in the complaint that, the agreement had been breached by their failure to pay according to the agreement. And the affidavit supported that allegation. Now, they do make a statement in their brief that there was no factual testimony. Well, there was factual testimony. It was in the form of affidavits. They presented affidavits. We presented affidavits. There's no evidence that they were prevented from presenting any argument that they wanted to make to avoid the bonding requirement. They very well could have come in and presented witnesses. There's no evidence that the trial court prevented them from presenting witnesses on the merits of the dispute to challenge whether the money was due. They instead chose to attack it on other grounds, and the grounds that they chose to attack it is that the statute simply didn't apply to them. And that was been their main...
The statute doesn't turn on whether the unauthorized insurer is likely to lose on the merits.
Well, Your Honor, it doesn't have that language, but there are other cases who have held. There's the Curiel case, which we cite, and then there's also the...
On the merits of the contract dispute? I mean, I'm looking at the statute, and all it says...
No, the statute doesn't. No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Maybe I misunderstood your question. What I was referring to was whether the statute comports with due process, and there are cases that state that it does require court supervision before the bond is issued,
Are they correct that you all have had this dispute before and never asked for a bond before?
No, I don't.
They said in their brief that for 8 years they've been paying you your claims. I mean, they paid a lot of money so far on asbestos.
Well, Your Honor, there have been a number of disputes.
And let me get to the bottom line. Y'all don't have, I mean, they posted this in cash.
Correct.
You did not ask for a bond because you were afraid if you won, you weren't going to be able to collect.
Your Honor, if you look at the record in this case, when it was filed, first of all, we...
Just, I'll let you explain, but answer my question. They posted the bond in cash. You all were not afraid when you asked for the bond that Lloyd's of London was not going to be good for the bill if they lost.
We were concerned with the lengths we would have to go to collect that money. And the reason is this. This CIP agreement actually settled initial coverage litigation in Beaumont, Texas. They wouldn't pay us the first go-around, and they had to be sued there. It resulted in this agreement. The agreement discusses what a covered claim is and talks about, with regard to the Worthington policies, that it's where Worthington or Dresser are named in a lawsuit and it alleges exposure to asbestos from a Worthington product. It defines what a covered claim is. It also states specifically that the agreement, the CIP agreement, permanently governs the application of the subject policies to the covered claims. This agreement has to do with the insurance business. There's no doubt about that. It's a claims handling adjustment agreement. If you were going to go and look at just regular long arm statute, it's a contract with a Texas resident involving matters in the state of Texas, including part performance, because the agreement specifically requires.
They don't dispute that.
And to say then that is not also doing the insurance business under the statute, to me, defies logic. To me,
suppose this was a bank. Suppose Lloyd's of London went bankrupt and these claims and liabilities were sold to a bank, and this is a bank that just said, you know, we'll pay these settlement amounts and you keep paying, we've taken some assets, we'll pay these settlement. I mean, it looks more like the business of insurance because it was an insurer that signed the CIP. If it had been somebody else, a bank or a government, let's say that a government and receivership took these, then it looks, the CIP looks less like a business of insurance, doesn't it?
I would agree with you. The point is, and to give some background, basically these London insurers have gone bankrupt once. In 1992, that's, in fact, the money that they claim was available, at least for as far as the underwriters are concerned, the underwriters portion of the relators, is actually held by Equitas, not actually by the London insurers. And if you look at the record in this case, as we stated, there was an initial mandamus to compel arbitration. That was denied. There was another, the mandamus was filed on that here with this court. It was denied on the issue of arbitration. The case was removed to federal court. It was remanded. Then the bonding requirement and the summary judgment finally came up after those delays, which lasted several years, I believe. Then we get to this issue, and we're still dealing with mandamus issues and not really getting into the merits of the case because we've been so distracted. And that's one of the things that mandamus is not supposed to be used to do, is to so disrupt the proceedings in the trial court. I believe, you know, does a bonding or a security requirement equal an attachment? I don't believe it does. But if so, then the issue is whether it constitutes a loss of rights that requires a review by mandamus, and is there an adequate remedy by appeal? I think there's a distinction here between a bond, whether a bond equals an attachment, and that it's such a deprivation of property rights that it requires due process. That's one issue.
But Peralta said a creditor can't come take your refrigerator and tell you, well, if you win a trial, you'll get it back on appeal. But apparently a creditor in a dispute can come take $11 million, and it's okay to tell you, well, you'll get it back on appeal. Now tell me why we're more concerned about the refrigerator than the $11 million.
Well, because this is there's no constitutional right to do the business of insurance in a particular state. And the states have the right to regulate insurance.
I'm not sure there's a constitutional right to own a refrigerator either. The question is, when you have property and somebody and a judge says, before the marriage, we're not deciding, this is not your day in court, we just want the asset. You give the asset to them, and then someday on appeal, maybe you'll get it back. How is the $11 million any less than the refrigerator?
Correct, and that's the due process requirement. And we're not disputing that there should be a due process requirement. What I was trying to make is that there's a distinction between an attachment, which requires making this bond equal an attachment, which requires due process, versus this bond equaling an attachment, which equates to such a loss of rights that it requires mandamus review.
Well, don't we have, I think don't we have to look carefully any time we say, before you can come into court and defend yourself against a suit that had been brought against you, you have to put up a bond, so much money. And that just seems to me to be a difficult proposition.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the cases have generally ruled that this regulatory scheme is constitutional. There is one other case, that I didn't cite, and I do want to cite to the court that I found. It's the Trihedron case out of California. It's at 218 Cal App 3D934, which finds this scheme constitutional. The Curiel case out of New York found it constitutional. And then the British Seguros case, which disagrees with Curiel on whether there's an attachment, whether it constitutes an attachment, finds that this scheme is constitutional.
Well, so, and that isn't that because the way to get out of the scheme is to qualify to do the insurance business,
yes,
in Texas and pay the cost that goes along with that.
Exactly. The two cases that the court recently decided on Friday, I think both of the decisions look at cite Walker versus Packer. I don't reject the proposition that there has to be a permanent loss of substantial rights. Both decisions, I believe one by Justice Owen and one by you, Justice Heck, talk about whether the rights are lost forever, whether the rights are utterly destroyed by the lack of the adequate remedy.
One case was both of those cases decided was where the woman was suing her insurance carrier, I believe for bad faith, and the trial court required the insurance carrier to pay her attorney's fees every month as those fees were incurred. And that opinion pointed out that the insurance company certainly had was not going to go bankrupt, and they certainly had the wherewithal to do that. But the fact that they were having to fund the opposition skewed the process. And so we recognize that it didn't have to be a permanent loss.
I don't disagree with that, but I think there has to be such a loss of rights that an appeal won't run. As I believe Justice O'Neill noted at the beginning of the argument, if they win, they will get their money back.
Well, in our case that we decided on mandamus, the insurance company could have gotten the attorney's fees back.
The other distinction here is they chose to file cash bond, or cash bond. They could have filed a bond, which then only results, really all they're out there and all they did talk about in their brief is a loss of the use of the money. The money is invested by order of the court, so there is some money being earned on it. Now, they made no showing, such as in Noteboom, the Noteboom case that they cite, where the bonding requirement or the security requirement was so devastating to the relator that he was going to lose his business. There's been no showing in this court that the bonding requirement in this case was going to destroy the business of the relators. In fact, their argument was, we have so much money available that, you know, you shouldn't even impose this bonding requirement on us. We've got $8 billion. Now, as I said, I believe the court did not clearly abuse its discretion because based upon the history of the case up until that point, with all the other mandamuses and the removal to federal court and the fact that the money, at least some of it, was held by Equitas, not actually by the relators, and not knowing what the procedures would be to obtain that money, there was no proof of how easy it was to get that money. I believe under those circumstances, the trial court did not abuse his discretion in issuing a bonding requirement.
So you're saying there's no evidence about what a cost bond would have cost at this amount of money?
There's no evidence of how much a cost bond would be. They made no showing.
And there's no, and all we have generally is that whatever the vague difference would be between what the money earned in as invested by the clerk, which we don't really know exactly what that would be, versus the potential investment return, which would be whatever they could invest the money in in if they were free to do whatever they wanted to. So we there's nothing more definitive than that.
There's absolutely nothing in the record, Your Honor, to show how much money they supposedly are losing as a result of having to file this cash bond. It's merely an allegation that they're losing money. And as I stated, it is invested.
How did the judge determine that $8 million was the right number?
Well, actually, the defendants themselves came in and asserted that they didn't owe the $11 million because there is a limitation in the agreement that only $4 million total can be paid out per year. So based upon the years that the contract was in effect, the amount due, they actually disputed, and this is a good point because this goes to the merits of the dispute, that they did have their day in court. We asserted in our affidavit that they paid, that they were billed $11 million and they owed $11 million. They actually disputed that and argued that, no, they didn't owe $11 million. They only owed $8 million because of the contract limitation on the total amount that can be paid per year. And as a result, the trial court actually did not grant the $11 million bond. It granted the $8 million bond. So I actually, that's a good point. I think that shows that they did have their day in court and they did have due process.
In the insurance code, section 101.051, which I mentioned earlier, there's the last item in that laundry list of acts constituting
yes.
the doing of business in insurance is number 10. It says,
yes.
any other transaction of business in the state by an insurer. Surely that's not to be read as broadly as it says, is it? If an insurance company buys a acre plot of land in West Texas, that's a transaction in the state. Does that constitute the doing of business of insurance?
That is, I would probably agree with you, Your Honor, that is not the insurance business, as I understand the insurance business, but adjusting losses and entering into claims handling agreements is traditionally the insurance business.
So section, this last sub-item 10, you believe should be read in context. It's not as broad as its language seems to suggest.
Well, if the court doesn't address it here, you may be addressing it in, I guess, the Strayhorn versus Lexington Insurance Company case, in which a petition was filed on June 24th. I haven't seen whether, obviously it's probably too early to determine whether petitions would be granted in that case, but in that case, the Austin Court of Appeals stated that, and it's a very short statement, but it says the definition of insurance business, therefore, is global, encompassing every conceivable form of business conducted by an insurer. So at least one court, the Austin Court of Appeals, this is a February 20, 2004 decision. It's at 128 Southwest 3D772. It tends to agree that it's a very broad, all-encompassing definition. But I would agree with you, Your Honor, if it's they bought a piece of real estate, that may not traditionally, in my mind, be the business of insurance. But to me, this coverage in place agreement is definitely part of the insurance business, because that's part of what insurers do, is pay claims and adjust claims and enter into claims handling agreements.
What's your view of the connection between the underlying insurance policies and this CIP? Your opposing counsel referred me to the definition of covered claim in CIP, which I've looked at again. Obviously, I have some thoughts. I may not give them to you today, but what's your view of the connection between the insurance contracts and the CIP?
Well, as I stated at page six, Roman numeral 2A, this agreement governs the application of those policies to the covered claims. I think there's a direct relationship here. You don't get paid under the policy unless you deal with this agreement. Now, I believe the term "it's not a contract of insurance," in where it was used in this document, was used to avoid the application of the doctrine of contra preferentum. That's my belief as to why it was used. regardless of whether I agree with you, this is not an insurance policy, but it does govern the application of those policies and how monies are going to be paid under them. And in my opinion, it is the doing, it's doing an insurance business. And again, it's an agreement with a Texas resident that was in part performable in Texas, and Texas law applies. Now, that's not necessarily determinative of jurisdiction, but nonetheless, it is something to keep in mind. Are there any more questions?
Any other questions? Thank you, Kevin.
Questions in the last argument. I think, Justice O'Neill, you may have used this phrasing. I think a couple of other questions hinted at this. Well, the way to get out of the statute is just to get in a different bucket. Let's think about the bucket here that the parties put themselves in beforehand. I've talked about Section 8 of the CIP, where the parties define what they are and are not going to do, where they say this is not a contract of insurance, where it does not affect obligations under the policies. The first line, strangely enough, of Section 8 says this agreement is the result of a compromise of a disputed claim. It is the product of arm's-length negotiations. And then it goes on to describe the various things that this agreement will and will not be after 13 pages of very detailed analysis. Some of the business issues between the parties. These people knew what they were doing. They said it, and they were careful to say it before they went into the discussion of whether this was insurance or not and whether it would affect the policies or not. And that's because they didn't think they were doing insurance business, and they didn't think they were subject to bonding requirements. That's not to be found anywhere in here.
But how relevant is their intent to whether they were actually doing insurance?
I think it's very relevant.
And that's a matter of law, isn't it?
It certainly is a question of law as to how you interpret this and how you apply it to the statute. But I think it goes to the question of Justice Wainwright about the property out in West Texas. That's pretty easy. If you look at the deed, it's property. It doesn't sound like insurance. This has got – it's more complex. And
I understand sort of that, but, I mean, parties couldn't get together and just say this is not going to be considered an insurance contract or doing the business of insurance in Texas and then –
certainly.
Come in here and do business in
certainly.
Texas if we're not bound by what they characterize.
Certainly true. And that would be, to take your example one step further, the introduction to this whole set of statutes says, watch out, we're worried about people in Texas getting swindled by unauthorized insurance companies not properly regulated. And you, of course, couldn't stick a little clause in an unfair policy and opt out of the insurance rules with that. But this isn't that situation. This is not protecting the vulnerable. These are two businesses getting together and doing a business deal to resolve threshold questions between them before you get to anything about these policies or anything covered by the statute.
Did the underlying policies provide insurance coverage for any Texas residents? Underlying policies.
There is no evidence in this record that they did, Your Honor. The evidence shows the insured was an out-of-state corporation, principal place of business out of state, and there are some 10-Ks and that sort of thing, and the Gagliano affidavit that go on to give more detail about that. That is the beginning and the end of the record evidence about where the original insureds were.
Let me ask you, following up on a question I asked earlier, about the connection between the insurance policies and the CIP and what the CIP really does. I understand there's an argument that it provides for adjustment of claims, that it is, in essence, part and parcel of resolving insurance coverage issues. You state in your brief that the CIP was intended, quote, to resolve complex coverage disputes relating to allocation of claims to the underlying policies of insurance, and to provide administrative rules relating to the processes of claims asserted by Dresser thereafter to be attributable to the underlying policies of insurance. A lot of words there.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Think of it as a stream. You have a stream of claims coming in. Flood, perhaps, is more apt for all the insurance claims relating to asbestos that are out there. The CIP takes a part of those claims and channels them off over here. The ones not addressed by the CIP are dealt with in other ways. We're not involved. The CIP ones come over here. And if you look at the attachments to the CIP, there are 20 policies or so. It's a mess. Which policy do you look at? How does it count? And when do you trigger it? Because these are all excess policies. Very hard questions to answer. The CIP answers those questions. It says, here's how we're going to allocate, and here's how we're going to figure out when we've exhausted, and here's how we're going to keep score. Now, if we've got the score set up, let's go on from there and apply whatever is to be done under the policies. And there's a paragraph that expressly reserves all defenses under the policies.
And you believe, let me follow up just briefly, and you believe that what you've just described is not contracting to provide in this state indemnification or expense reimbursement for medical expense by direct payment or otherwise?
No. The policies are what can give the rise to that liability. And those policies are issued long ago, the subject of my statutory arguments in my earlier examination.
And the CIP you just described, you believe, does not provide for a transaction of a matter after the effectuation of a contract that arises out of the insurance contract?
Read consistently, of course, with the exception in the next paragraph. But yes, even on its own terms, these people entered a business solution to the business problem and left the issue of policy defenses for another day.
Okay, so if all of these contracts were before the trial court and helped the trial court, and the trial court had to go through and made a decision on coverage, on excess coverage, and determined that these claims were covered, does the statute reach them?
Does the statute reach a trial court's a suit for coverage on a policy?
Yeah, if y'all hadn't entered into the CIP and it went to court, the court had to sort through all these policies and determine whether you were covered as an excess or not.
Right.
Then the court says, yes, you are. Is that covered?
Absent the CIP. Absent the CIP, the statute has nothing to do with London because of the issue about regulating past sales out of state, insurance subjects out of state that the Commerce Clause cases talk about that the exception picks up. That set of facts could not be covered by the statute, and Dresser's only hook to the statute is to cite something about the CIP in my analysis of those facts.
See, would your opinion change, and would you agree with your opposing counsel that this CIP does provide for business of insurance if there was evidence in the record that the underlying insurance policies covered residents of Texas? You keep pointing to the exception 101.053. BA is the exception I think you're talking to.
That's correct.
So if there was evidence in the record that there are residents of Texas covered by the insurance policies, would your position change?
It would have to be at the relevant time.
Between 1954 and 1973?
At the time of sale, or the time of the policies initially attaching. But if that evidence is there, there is certainly a stronger argument for the statute applying.
Any other questions? Thank you. Let me take another brief recess.